Good morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower here till 5 a.m. It's Monday. That means Monday morning movie reviews are about to take off right now. And my dad's going to call in later on to tell a joke because it's Monday and it's a jokey time. Also, Vulture.com put out a ranking of all 169 episodes of Seinfeld. They ranked them from worst to best or best to worst, however you want to do it. We're going to talk about that list and talk about the best and worst Seinfeld episodes. It's an interesting article. I don't necessarily agree. In fact, I don't agree with a lot of where they ranked the episodes. And of course, I've seen all 169 episodes of Seinfeld like 50 times each. So we'll get to that a little bit later. So that's your Monday morning, but we're going to start with the movie reviews as we do every Monday morning. Nick DiGilio here. So Eric Childress, Colin Suter, join me every week. You can read them at efilmcritic.com, rogerebert.com, and more. We'll talk about the movies, and then Eric will stick around, and we'll give you a little box office analysis as well. So let's get started. Here's Eric. Hi, Eric.
Hello.
And Colin. Hey, Colin.
Hello there.
Welcome back, Colin. How you feeling?
Very good. Thank you very much.
Good. I'm glad you're doing well.
Yeah.
Yeah, we missed you last week, man.
Thank you. I missed being here.
Yeah. Hey, I want to mention very quickly, Saturday night, two nights ago, I was lucky enough to do the introduction and like have a little 10-minute talk before Phantasm Remastered at the Music Box. And I was stunned by the amount of people that showed up. I mean, it was packed. And I didn't expect this weird little movie from 37 years ago suddenly packs the Music Box. And it was really fantastic. And I was, boy, was I with my brethren. Oh, man.
Well, it was part of the whole art house day, too. So they did Time Bandits, too, right?
Yeah, they did Time Bandits. But, you know, they didn't do it because the Music Box, before the event happened, the art house theater event, they had booked the premiere of a Swedish film at 7. So they couldn't show Phantasm at the same time and then get the live Q&A stream that all the other theaters were getting.
Got it.
So, which is one of the reasons I was there, because they wanted at least somebody who knew the movie to give like some background and some of the details about the restoration. So, it was part of the art house thing. And one of the last things I said, I told the Avco Embassy logo story.
Right.
Which I was very happy about telling, and everybody, you know, was like, they thought it was very, very funny. And I felt really, really wonderfully accomplished, because when I got off the stage after my intro, and at the end of my intro, I've said, I've been waiting to say this for 37 years, Phantasm is now an art house film. And everybody just erupted with applause. and then I walked off the stage, and I walked to the back, and I sat down. I was only going to walk, because I'm going to see it again next, I'm going to see Remastered again on October 8th. Because there's this big event that Flashback is sponsoring at Movieco. It's a big 12-hour horror-thon. Have you guys heard about this one?
Yeah.
They're going to be doing Night of the Living Dead, Fright Night, Bubba Hotep, Nightmare on Elm Street, Phantasm Remastered, and followed by the big, you know, the big premiere of Phantasm Ravager, Phantasm 5. And I'm going to be there. I'm going to host that. So I'm going to see Remastered again then. So I figured I'd only stay for the first few minutes, but I felt very accomplished, because when I got off stage, I walked back and I sat down in the back, and then the Music Box previews came on and all that stuff, and then they did a 5-minute behind the scenes of Ravager and a tribute to Angus Scrimm, which was really sweet and really nice, and then the movie began, and I felt very happy about myself, because when the Avco Embassy logo came on, it got applause and laughter. So I was like, all right, cool. The story stuck with them. That's great.
Right.
So anyway, that was a lot of fun. That was really, really cool. And I was surprised. I just was really genuinely surprised at the amount of people that came out for it. I just didn't expect that. And it's just so weird that this weird little movie that just like struck me as a 13 and a 14-year-old, 37 years later, there's people across the country watching it at art houses. It just seems weird to me. I don't know. So, anyway. All right. That was fun, though. And we've got some movies to talk about, new movies to talk about here, as we often do. And let's see. Hey, Colin, I didn't get a chance to see this. And I guess, Eric, you didn't get a chance to see the Queen of Katwe then, did you?
No.
Okay. Colin, tell us about that one. This one looks really interesting. And it snuck up on me. I didn't even know it opened this week.
Yeah. It's got kind of a quiet opening. It's from Disney. Disney, you know, above the title, the Disney logo above the title, and it's playing at art houses. Again, that's another thing.
Yeah.
Art house oddity.
Yeah, yeah. And by the way, when was the last time? When was the last time Mironaire directed a movie?
It was the Amelia Earhart film.
Hilary Swank.
What was the namesake after Amelia?
Oh, the namesake. That's right. She directed the namesake.
I think it was before Amelia.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure about that.
I totally forgot about the namesake, which is a good film. Anyway, I like this director. She's done great work.
Yeah, she has. So this one, The Queen of Katwe. This takes place in the slums of Kampala, Uganda. Tells a true story of Fiona Metusi, who's here. She's played by a newcomer named Medina Nawanga. And Fiona, at 10 years old, started learning to play chess at a sort of a youth retreat place run by a minister here, played by David Oyelowo. And he teaches chess to young kids. And she takes a liking to the game, and the film covers 5 years in her life as she went from, you know, a slum kid to a chess prodigy. And she lives with her, you know, domineering, protective mother, played by Lupita Nyong'o, who's, you know, she's not crazy about the idea of letting her daughter out of the neighborhood, let alone out of Uganda. But she gets better and better with age, as does her younger brother. He's involved in this too. And they see it as a way out of the slums. But, you know, her mother's so rigid and, you know, not used to the idea of having a better life than what they have right now. This is directed by, like we said, Mira Nair, who's probably most famously known for directing Salaam Bombay and Mississippi Masala. I mean, this is a woman who really knows her country. You know, she really has a real, affection for wherever she's filming. She really picks up the flavor of it and really, is good at putting the viewer in that time and place. Without sugarcoating it. And you would think, Disney above the title, that this would be sugarcoated. And it's not. This is a movie that feels very authentic. It takes place in Uganda, and the characters are allowed to speak their native tongue once in a while. So you get subtitles in this one sometimes, which is really nice. I think the performances are really terrific. This newcomer, this Medina Nawanga, you know, she plays Fiona throughout the whole film. Fiona ages, 5 years throughout the film, and she does a really wonderful job of going from an adolescent to a teenager. Just her body language, her appearance. She does a really wonderful job, this young actress, of, you know, making you believe that this Fiona is going through 5 years of her life, discovering, a love of something, discovering a passion for it, to the point where, you know, she gets angry whenever she loses. Earlier in the year, I, gave a very favorable, very good review to a movie called The Dark Horse, which was a lot like this. It was a chess movie that was, told the story of, that we've seen many, many times in a sports movie, had the same structure as, any other true story sports movie that we've seen. And this is the same thing, but it overcomes, the trappings and the cliches of being an inspirational true story right down to the closing credits. When you see a movie that's based on real life characters, you see Polaroids or something, photos of the real characters.
Yeah, like they did they did at the end of Sully.
Right. They do it a lot, and it's cool. But Mira Nair does a really wonderful twist on it. That is just fantastic, and actually goes a step further during the end credits. There's a wonderful musical sequence. So definitely, if you're going to go see this movie, definitely stay for the whole thing. it's a beautifully shot film. The colors really pop in this thing, and the performances are terrific. And this is a really wonderful film that we've seen a few times before, but in the hands of a director like this, it really soars. And it's I very much recommend it.
I'm really glad to hear that, man, because I really like her work a lot. It's called Queen of Katwe, and it's playing at the River East, the Landmark Century Cinema in Chicago, and at the Crestwood 18, oddly.
Yeah, that's odd. But I think it'll. I think it might open wide. I mean, it's a crowd pleaser.
Yeah.
So, you know.
You know, I saw the trailer for it. You know, a couple of months ago, I saw the trailer for it, and I was like, "Wow, it looks great." I can't wait to see it because they mentioned her name in the credits as the director, and I was like, "Oh, cool!" And you know, mm-hmm. It looked interesting, and it had and it looked good, and then. I didn't even realize it came out until you added it to our list, Colin.
Yeah, I didn't realize it was coming out this weekend either. I thought it was going to be in October.
Yeah.
And suddenly there it was. So.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, Queen of Katwe is out, and it's really good, and you should see it, and that's Colin's recommendation. All right, guys, hang on, all right?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Eric and Colin are here, and we're reviewing the new movies, and we'll continue to review the new movies coming up. We got a bunch of them this week as well. So more movie reviews coming up, but we got a break here for the news. And after the news, more movie reviews on 720 WGN. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're back, and we're reviewing the new movies. It's Monday, and we do the Monday morning movie reviews. And, of course, it's Monday, so my dad will be calling in later on to tell a joke. It's a jokey time. Vulture.com decided to rank all 169 episodes of Seinfeld. Every episode of Seinfeld, ranked them from best to worst. I'm going to go down that list and talk about the best and worst Seinfeld episodes. That's on the show this morning as well. But let's get back to the movie reviews. We're here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich here at 5. And, of course, Steve Cochran at 6 with your morning drive. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. You can also check us out on Facebook and Twitter at Nick D Show. All right, let's welcome back Eric and Colin. Welcome back, guys.
Thank you.
All right, Eric, let's get back to it. I didn't get a chance to see this one. I was really curious about it. It's playing at the Music Box, but it's also on VOD, and that's GOAT, which you mentioned on the show. What film festival did you see it?
It premiered at Sundance.
You saw it at Sundance. Okay,
yeah.
So this is a movie called GOAT, which you can see on VOD. And it's at the Music Box. So tell us about that.
Okay. Well, this is a movie that I just mentioned premiered at Sundance where I saw it. And it was good enough that we premiered it in Chicago at our film festival this past May. And it's a story of a young guy who's about to get into college pledge a new college. And his brother's he's played by Ben Schnetzer. And his brother's played by Nick Jonas, and he goes to one of his fraternity parties, and on the way out, as he's leaving home, kind of a shy, keeps to himself kind of guy, and as he's leaving the party, he is sort of duped into taking a pair of hitchhikers on a ride, and who believe that they're part of the fraternity as well, but turns out they're actually not. And they beat him to almost to within an inch of his life. They beat him very badly. So in the course of discovering whether or not he can identify who actually did this to him, it follows him as he ends up pledging the same fraternity that his brother does. And this movie then becomes the story of his growth within the sort of the hazing rituals that take place within the fraternity, and a large midsection of this movie deals with the just sort of brutal, absolutely ridiculous hazing rituals that these men go through, and so we sort of start to see this transformation process within this young man and how he begins to adapt, how he believes he might be getting stronger, how if something like this incident that happened to him in the beginning of the film were to happen to him again, would he react differently to it now that he's become a little bit more wiser and sort of has his brotherhood backing him in a way. This is a very interesting film. It was directed by a guy named Andrew Neil, who did a wonderful documentary called Darkon.
Yeah, about LARPing.
Yeah, and he also did another movie a few years ago from South by Southwest called King Kelly that dealt with a a girl who was on had like her own webcam series and was sort of an exhibitionist. So this is a director who's clearly interested in stories about sort of people finding sort of social situations that suit their their lifestyle and their what they just the, sort of the sense of belonging and wanting to belong to something. And easy to sort of look at this as sort of a study of masculinity. There's Moonlight that's coming out later this year is sort of a bit of more of a more subtle take on that theme. But it is a film that sort of really is sort of centralized and it's based on a true story. It's co-written by David Gordon Green. And it's a story about, getting us inside the what happens at, some of these fraternity hazing rituals. It's really kind of horrifying stuff. It's very uncomfortable at times, but in a way that doesn't feel manipulative at all. It feels like a movie that actually has something to say about what it's like to discover yourself at this kind of age and what it means to be a man. Doesn't necessarily mean being strong and vengeful, or is it just the sense of comfort that comes with knowing that someone's going to have your back, whether it be an actual brother or a fictional one. I think it's an interesting film. Obviously, we liked it enough at the Sundance to bring it to Chicago, and I think it's definitely worth checking out.
Okay. All right. And Colin, what about you?
Yeah, I liked it too. Liking that it accomplished what it set out to accomplish. It's a very unpleasant experience to watch. And you can tell that it's kind of directed by, a guy who comes from a documentary background. A lot of this movie, you kind of feel like a fly on the wall, eavesdropping on these things. And it's very unflinching and, like we said, unpleasant. I mean, the hazing in this movie, makes the hazing in Dazed and Confused look like, Weekend at Disneyland. James Franco has a terrific cameo in the film. One scene, kind of a walk-on as a guy who graduated from this school but never really grew up. And, helps welcome the incoming freshman by giving a speech on, the importance of brotherhood. It's a brilliant scene, and it kind of sums up the movie pretty nicely. Yeah, no, this is definitely a movie worth checking out, and this is a director to, keep an eye on. But it is not an easy movie to watch at times, but it's definitely made with a lot of skill and very beautifully acted. So also very much recommended.
Okay. And that movie is called Goat. It is playing at the Music Box Theater, but you can also see it on video on demand. And I'm definitely going to watch that at some point this week. No question about it. Okay. Colin, tell us about what is The Dressmaker?
Another little art house film that came out this weekend. This stars Kate Winslet as a kind of fashion guru dressmaker, of course, who returns to this small town in rural Australia where her mom lives. And her mom is played by Judy Davis, who is almost unrecognizable here. All the women in this town are, they dress in regular school marm clothing. This movie takes place in the 30s or 40s. I'm not sure. I can't really remember what the time period was. But she manages to transform these women in this town into confident, beautiful women by designing dresses for them that a movie star would wear down a red carpet. But she has a deeper past in this small town, that she was accused of murdering a boy when she was younger. And many people in the town still feel that she did it, even though nobody really has proof. So her welcome is worn out rather quickly by many people in this town. But more people in the town love her because of what she has done for their fashion sense, I guess. And really, she couldn't care. She's the kind of person who couldn't care less what people think of her. But she does have ulterior motives for being back in town in the first place. So So Kate Winslet, I love always watching, seeing Kate Winslet in anything, but especially a comedy. And, Dressmaker is definitely a comedy. she's terrific in it. Everybody, the cast is, you know, across the board, really terrific in this film. The cinematography is beautiful. It captures the landscape the really well, and the, you know, the flashback scenes, they kind of reminded me of the look of The Witch from earlier this year. It has that kind of feel to it in the flashbacks. The score is really wonderful. A lot of things, a lot of people showed up and brought their A game to this film. The problem with it is the story and just how cluttered it is. There's so much going on in this thing that it just starts to feel excessive in terms of plot, in terms of, you know, how many characters we have to get to know and, you know, their past that we have to get to know for them. And the movie can't decide on a tone overall. The movie is directed by Jocelyn Morehouse. And,
By the way, she directed two of my favorite movies, two movies that I absolutely adore that came out in the 90s, Thousand Acres, and especially, you guys see the movie Proof? Hugo Weaving is a blind guy, and he trusts Russell Crowe? To describe things to him, and he takes pictures. He's a blind guy who takes pictures. Makes friends with Russell Crowe. Who he trusts to describe the pictures to him and be his best friend, but he starts screwing around with a girl that he loves.
That I did not.
Yeah.
It is a great movie. A great movie. I mean, it came out in 1991, so it's 25 years old, but it is a tremendous movie but Hugo Weaving and Russell Crowe are amazing in it, and it's a beautiful, beautiful movie. Anyway, I'm sorry, Colin, but that is a terrific movie if you've not seen it.
Yeah, I have. I did see it. I barely remember it, though. I haven't seen it in 25 years. But yeah, but this movie, it's weighed down by, you know, it's based on a book, and I have a feeling it's just being way too faithful to the book. It just needs to cut back on a lot of, you know, what's happening here. Like a lot of the, you know, audience members that I, you know, talked to and everything were just a little confused. But so, like, what we're supposed to get out of this story, and it's really too bad because there's a lot of, you know, greatness in it in terms of just the performances on the screen and the cinematography and everything. That's all there. It's all great, but there's just something about the story and the delivery and the tone that is just really inconsistent and really frustrating.
Hmm.
So, you know, I can't really recommend it, but, you know, if you want to see, if you want to be reminded of just, you know, how sexy Kate Winslet is, what a great comedic actress she can be, like, this is a really good example of that. It's just, unfortunately, she's not given the best material to work with.
Okay.
So,
all right. It's playing at the Century in Evanston, the River East down here, and at the Arclight in Chicago, and that's called The Dressmaker. Okay, guys, hang on. All right. Take a break. We got more movies to talk about right here on 720 WGN with Eric and Colin. And that's coming up right after we take a break here on WGN. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. We're in the middle of our movie reviews every Monday morning. Eric and Colin join me. All right. Eric, why don't you tell us about My Blind Brother?
Okay, here's another film from the film festival circuit, premiered at South by Southwest this year, and we brought it to Chicago for our film festival in May. So that's two this week, getting their official opening. And this one is a comedy, stars Nick Kroll and Adam Scott as brothers. As you might tell from the title, one of them is blind, and that is Adam Scott. He is certainly not going to let his blindness overcome him in any way, shape, or form. He is most decidedly an overachiever. He has taken his handicap to an extreme level. He runs marathons. He does all kinds of community outreach work. But the thing is that he always has to be pretty much tied up to his brother, played by Nick Kroll, because he's blind and can't see where he's going. So Nick Kroll's brother, his older brother, is a little bit more of a ne'er-do-well, not quite focused in his life, likes to smoke pot, and he's a bit of a mess. And one evening he meets another mess in a bar, played by Jenny Slate. And they have a good time together and have a one-night stand. And then they go their separate ways until she ends up meeting his brother, and becomes basically his personal assistant. So then the two of them form a relationship, but Nick Kroll realizes that he really has some lingering feelings for her, and so it becomes this love triangle, whether or not the ne'er-do-well can take her away from the perfect brother that he's always had to have a hand in. It sounds like a very sort of conventional type of romantic triangle movie, but it's better than that. And one of the reasons it's better than that is because the performances by the three of them are much better than your average rom-com might have. Nick Kroll, who I've been kind of wishy-washy in the past. I think he's done some – sometimes he makes me laugh. Sometimes he does some decent work. But I kind of go back and forth on him. I think this is the best performance he's given to date. I think he's really good in this film, and he's matched by Jenny Slate, who is just really sort of a welcome presence in any film, even bad films. I saw a really bad movie at Toronto this year that she was in, and just anytime she was on screen, I perked up. And you'll definitely perk up with her in this movie too. I think the two of them are really good together. And Adam Scott obviously becomes the foil for the two of them, and is as funny as he just about always is. I wish his character had been fleshed out a little bit more, and he wasn't just sort of the one-note overachieving jerk that he's portrayed for a good portion of the movie. They give him a little bit more to work with later on in the film, but it really sort of serves as to sort of give Nick Kroll bigger moments for his character as well. I think this movie is very funny. Like I said, it's far better than your average rom-com, and just the performances alone, I think, make this movie worth checking out.
Yeah, I watched it over the weekend, and I really liked it. I thought it was really great. And you're right. I mean, it sounds as though it is, really cliched and whatnot. But the performances, as you mentioned, are so good that it overcomes what is a pretty, standard rom-com situation comedy movie. But it is the three performers that really, really kick this up. And I also like – I don't know who the guy is. I also like the guy who played the – who played – the blind pothead.
Yeah.
Who I thought was hilarious. And I also loved Jenny Slate's roommate.
Zoe Kazan.
Yeah, she's great. And they, the double date scene is pretty spectacular.
That's a really good scene.
Yeah, it's a great scene.
Yeah.
And there's really good, a lot of great stuff in this movie. There's a real sentence. There's what you didn't mention in the plot sort of synopsis is the background of Jenny Slate's character. I don't know if she's going to specialize in playing these kinds of roles of somebody who like really feels terrible about their lot in life and where they are and don't know what to do and are completely confused. But her motivation for helping out Adam Scott's character, training and is purely selfish. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's completely and utterly selfish. She doesn't know where she is. She did something in her past. She broke up with a guy that may or may not have killed him when she broke up with him. And that fuels everything that she does, including thinking, oh, I'll just help a blind guy out, and it'll make everything right. And on that level, her and Nick Kroll's character, there's an absolute need for these two people to be together. And yeah, Adam Scott does have the one dimensional thing, but it really, I think there's a huge payoff at the end of the movie. I really do, and I bought it that in the last like 5 minutes of the movie. There's a big, big scene between Adam Scott and Nick Kroll that I think pays off emotionally really beautifully. And there's also a scene where he, because Nick Kroll is always in the opening scene of the movie. Is Adam Scott running a 26-mile marathon and Nick Kroll attached to him because he has to, like, guide him. So he just ran a 26-mile marathon, but nobody cares about about the guy who's, like, dying. He's, like, at the beginning of the movie, he runs a 26-mile marathon to help his blind brother and gets no acknowledgement whatsoever from anyone, and especially Adam Scott.
Yeah.
And it's a great way to open the movie. It really sets up the dynamic perfectly, and the way that his parents treat him. I also love the scenes where they let Adam Scott drive the car.
Yes.
very funny, really well done stuff. But there's a really great moment in the movie, one of my favorite moments in the movie, and it's finally at the end of the movie, he's going to try to break this record, as you said, swimming. Mm-hmm. And so he thrives on attention and thrives on the fact that the local television comes and interviews him, and he's like a local hero. So they're interviewing him, and in the background is Nick Kroll, you know, like putting up a sign that says, "We love Robbie," which is pretty much all he does.
Yeah.
He's like, make signs that say, "We love Robbie," because he works in a print shop. But he puts up this, he's putting up the sign, and Adam Scott says, "Why don't you come up here?" And this is like in the movie, it's the first time that he's ever acknowledged anything that that Nick Kroll has done for him publicly. He brings him up and then proceeds to just reveal this horrible, horrible secret.
Yeah.
And when you see the scene, you got to watch Nick Kroll because his acting is beautiful. He doesn't say a word after it's revealed what happened. Doesn't say a word, and just kind of like you can just see it all in his face. You see him walk away, and you see Jenny Slate's reaction. And that, to me, that scene pretty much sums up the entire movie and why it's so good.
Like, and there's another really great wordless scene that you mentioned with Nick Kroll. There's a scene that involves the three of them on a couch. And Nick Kroll has to express his feelings for Jenny Slate on the dry erase board or whatever. And it's beautifully funny, and it's romantic and charming, and there's moments like that that really
there's another moment another moment in the movie where it's the greatest scene I've ever seen where a guy is trying to put his arm through a sleeve. And I won't get into it, but it's Nick Kroll doing great physical work. I really like this movie a lot. It's on demand right now. And I highly recommend it. I think it's terrific. Three great performances. And I am in love with Jenny Slate. I love her.
We all are.
So, yeah, I know. All right. And Colin, you didn't see it.
No, I missed it at our festival. Okay. And it kind of snuck up on us this weekend.
Yeah, you got to try and check it out. It's real short.
Yeah.
You know, it's real short. It's like 85 minutes long. So you're in, you're out. All right. So hang on, guys. We got to take a break. After the news, we got more movies to review right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate studio, 7th floor of the Trip Tower, here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich with the opening bell. Steve Cochran at 6 with Morning Drive. Our phone number and text number, 312-981-7200. Check us out on Facebook, facebook.com/Nick D Show. Like us there and follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. All right, get back to the movie reviews, and we'll talk box office as well with Eric Childress and Colin Suter. And here is Eric, and here is Colin. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Okay, Colin, let's talk about Storks.
All right. So this is an animated film from Warner Brothers, and it's co-written and directed by Nicholas Stoller, who, of course, you know, did The Muppets. And it tells the story of storks who deliver babies. They used to, anyway. Now they're modernized, and now they deliver packages a la Amazon because they realize that humans have other ways of making babies that kind of renders the storks obsolete. You know, this is one of those movies where you just have to go with the concept and not think about it too much. But an order comes in from a young suburban boy who doesn't want to be an only child anymore. And the film tells his story, too. And the main character here, though, in the stork place is a stork named Junior, voiced by Andy Samberg. And he's about to take over the company from his father, voiced by Kelsey Grammer. And there's also a woman, the only female, or I mean, it's the only human working in this place is a woman named Tulip, voiced by Katie Crown, who was, you know, she was a baby who was left behind many, many years ago. And now she's an employee at this place. They give her kind of a menial job to kind of keep her out of the way. Long story short, the order for the baby comes in, and Junior and Tulip do what they can to make the delivery of the baby happen using whatever odd mode of transportation they can find to get them from one end of the earth to another. So it's kind of a buddy road trip comedy where they meet all kinds of odd characters along the way, including a pack of wolves who can strangely fashion themselves into any mode of transportation as they chase Tulip and Junior through the caves. They turn themselves into a large boat, a large submarine, a large car. You know, it's a very odd, but very clever sight gag that these wolves do. And they're voiced by Key and Peele, I believe, the two main wolves.
Yep.
It's also, a really clever fight scene in which everybody has to be quiet while they're fighting so they don't wake the baby. I think my main issue with the film is the storks themselves. I didn't find them very, charming or engaging or all that funny. I kind of felt they were kind of giving, I think Sandberg's character is kind of a one-note character that we've seen many, many times before. And I didn't feel that invested in that side of it. I felt more invested in the human characters, actually. I think the stuff with the boy who wants a little brother, I thought was really sweet and nicely done. His parents are voiced by Ty Burrell and Jennifer Aniston. And I really liked that side of it. And I really liked the character of Tulip, who's voiced by Katie Crown, who I'm not that familiar with. I guess she's done a lot of voice work and a lot of TV work and stuff that I just have never seen before. And I guess she's a stand-up comedian too. And I thought she's wonderful. I thought that was the stuff that in the movie that I really liked the most were the human characters, not so much the storks. But I think there's enough cleverness here, a lot of laughs. You can kind of tell that Warner Brothers is sort of finding its voice as an animation studio, especially after the Lego movie. There's a Lego short before this one I didn't think was all that great, but you can kind of tell that the studio is saying, oh, we should be making kind of snarky, animated films, working with guys like Nicholas Stoller and, Park and Miller to make our films, which is a good move. Stoller has, a good feel for this kind of material. And it's interesting to watch a movie that is conceptually strange, but actually kind of pulls it off regardless. You don't have to really worry about taking your kids to see this and having to explain, too much to them afterwards. I don't think it's a great animated film, but I think it's just fun and funny enough to recommend.
Yeah, I didn't. There are moments in it that I like, Colin, but overall, I'm not going to recommend it. I didn't find any of the characters particularly compelling, not even the humans very much. Also, being an only child, I take offense at some of the stuff in this movie. And I'm joking, but I'm not.
But I just
didn't. There were laughs in it, to be sure. There's some funny stuff, funny things, and I think the funniest stuff in the movie are the wolves, quite frankly. It never really took off. No pun intended. It never really took off for me. There was no emotional investment. Few gags here and there were funny. I didn't think it was particularly beautifully animated or anything. And I always find it kind of funny when they start doing the from the studio that brought you.
Right.
Because they could have said, Magnificent Seven when they released Magnificent Seven is from the studio that brought you Gone with the Wind. They can do that,
Yeah.
It's just ridiculous. This is from the studio that brought you the Lego movie. So you're thinking, oh, it's the Lego, but it's not the people who put the Lego movie together, they're not involved in this. So I just find that a little bit misleading. Laughs here and there, and like you, some of the vocal work for me really stood out, particularly Katie Crown, and I'm not really familiar with her work either. I know that she's done voices in the past. She's also appeared on Bob's Burgers, and I wasn't familiar with her as a stand-up, but she's really sweet and funny and does a really nice job. And it's interesting to hear the difference between somebody who's trained to do that and then somebody like Andy Sandberg, who sounds exactly like Andy Sandberg. But there are some funny things in the movie. There's no doubt about it. And obviously you could do worse than this, but I'm way mixed on this, more negative than positive. It's not terrible. I just don't think it's very good. But, if you're in a pinch, you want to take your kids to see a movie, you could do a lot worse than this. So, all right. Well, let's see. Let's do this. Eric, why don't you tell us about The Magnificent Seven? That's our last film for the week here to talk about.
Okay. Well, you may have heard of this movie that came out in 1960 that was actually a Western version of Akira Kurosawa's Seven Samurai. And now it's been updated. It's still set in the Old West, obviously, but a remake of the remake. The Magnificent Seven. Peter Sarsgaard plays a land baron who comes into a small town and basically inflicts his will on them and causes a lot of havoc if they do not cooperate with his plans for the region. Ends up killing a number of people, including the husband of a young woman played by Haley Bennett, who then goes out to seek vengeance and find people that will come and protect their town from the baddie Sarsgaard. She finds Denzel Washington's bounty hunter, who's clearly watched a lot of Django Unchained in his time. And then he begins to form basically the Magnificent Seven, and he brings along Chris Pratt, who's sort of your typical drunken lout Western character, is there for comic relief. You have Ethan Hawke, who is an ex Confederate War Civil War fighter who has some PTSD problems. Vincent D'Onofrio is kind of a Grizzly Adams kind of guy living off the land who might have some crazy issues of himself. Then you've got Byung-Hyun Kim, who plays a fellow fighter alongside Ethan Hawke. And then, as Chris Pratt likes to say in the movie, they bring in a Mexican and an Indian out your Magnificent Seven. Mm-hmm. They come in to protect the town, and all hell breaks loose.
Right. Okay. Well,
that's your setup.
Okay. All right. Well, what did you think of it?
Oh, okay. I thought we were going to take a break.
No, we're going to break after you give your review. And
after
then we'll
I give my review.
Yeah.
I think the film's okay. Watching the film, you know, I kind of like these types of old school westerns. You know, I'm a huge fan, obviously, of the original film. I really love that picture. And, you know, to see, you know, sort of the battle lines drawn between your good guys, you know, a team of good guys, a bigger team of bad guys, and just, you know, pit them against each other and just like guns blazing and riding horses and all the kinds of stuff that you expect out of a fun B Western film they're all inherent. They're all in this film, which is really beautifully shot. Cinematography is really gorgeous in this film. The problem is that beyond the shootouts, which I'll get to in a second, is that the cast of this movie is stuck somewhere between the fun of a movie like The Magnificent Seven and the utter seriousness of something like The Seven Samurai. And I don't know if I've ever seen Denzel Washington more bored in a picture. The only time he ever seems to really come to life in the movie is when Ethan Hawke shows up, and they have a little moment between them. I think Chris Pratt just continues to be miscast in movies like this. I know he's trying, and I like the guy, and it just seems like, you know, with this and Guardians and Jurassic World, he's just trying too hard to be that sort of that off-kilter likability factor that a lot of people do a lot more naturally. Yet he's the only one in the entire cast, at least on the Magnificent Seven side, that seems to be having some fun with the role. I think Ethan Hawke is pretty good. I think Sarsgaard is probably the best, gives the best performance in the movie. I like the shootout stuff, it's nice to hear Elmer Bernstein's theme at the end of the movie.
That was really nice. I didn't expect that.
That kind of sent me off on a little bit of a high. So I was kind of like, I'll kind of like the movie. And then the more I thought about it, the more the flaws started to seep in. And I mentioned this from Toronto's that I am just utterly shocked that this movie got a PG-13 rating.
Yeah, I'm with you on that.
I cannot believe.
I'm with you on that. It's gotta be the highest body count in PG-13 history.
I tweeted afterwards that I think that this has as high a body count as Commando does.
Oh, yeah, it's got to be.
In the climax of the movie.
It's got to be. It's hundreds of people die in this movie.
Yeah, I mean, before they even whip out the Gatling gun, once they whip out the Gatling gun, the body count triples. It's kind of a mixed bag. Like, if I saw it on cable, I wouldn't turn it off. Antoine Fuqua, who I was defending in Toronto, I'm like, I think I like more of this guy's movies than most people do. And then when I heard his resume read at the premiere of The Magnificent Seven, I was just like, maybe I don't. Mm. And actually, my favorite tweet of the week that I saw is that someone said that even the birth certificates of Antoine Fuqua's kids say from the director of Training Day, which I think kind of sums it up pretty, you know, his career pretty well.
That's good, man.
Okay. You know, your dad will like it. That's what I'm telling people.
Well, my dad did like it, but we'll talk about that in a minute. All right. Hang on a second. Colin and Eric are with me, and we've got the Magnificent Seven to review. And wait a second. I just want to make sure. Colin, you didn't see it, did you?
I did not.
Okay. All right. Well, then I guess we can let you go to sleep.
Okay.
Yeah, since we're not – this is the last movie we're going to review. Oh, I just hung up on him. That was fantastic. I just hung up on him. I guess we can let you go to sleep, click.
That was like straight out of a horror movie.
That was terrible. Can you get Colin back just so we can have a proper goodbye? All right, Eric, hang on. I'm such a jerk. We'll come back and we'll give Colin a proper goodbye, and then I'll review The Magnificent Seven. And then we got the box office to talk about as well. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. We're going to talk about the box office. I'm going to give you my review of The Magnificent Seven. And much more coming up. My dad will call in and tell a joke and more. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, I didn't mean to hang up on you, man.
That's okay. That was pretty funny.
Yeah, it was pretty funny. But I'll give my quick review, and then we'll all preview what's coming up next week. So Magnificent Seven, I liked it more than you did, Eric. Actually, I liked it. I thought it was pretty great. Not great, but it's a fun movie. I liked the acting more than you did, I thought Chris Pratt was funny. He was doing what I guess he does in all his movies now, but I thought he was funny and he did it well. I thought Vincent D'Onofrio was really pretty great in this.
I liked him.
It's a weird character, and, I think he evokes the most sympathy of any of the characters in the movie, quite frankly. Denzel just seems to be, you know, just doing the bag of tricks that Denzel has. Although there was really, I don't know. I loved watching him and Ethan Hawke together again. I don't know. That just made me happy. I thought Ethan Hawke was good. I thought the action sequences were really nicely done. I think this is the best movie and I'm with you on the director. But I think this is the best movie he's done since Training Day. There's some really beautifully put together sequences, and again, it's shot beautifully. I have a question about James Horner getting credit. Did he start the score and then pass away?
Yes. Fuqua brought that up at the premiere. Actually, he said that they had hired James Horner to do the score, they kind of talked to him about it, and then even before they officially hired him, he had already started writing pieces of music for the movie, and he wrote some six pieces of finished pieces before they even shot a frame of film.
Okay.
He obviously passed away.
When I saw his name on the credits, I was like, what? You know?
Yeah.
Obviously he's credited with another composer who probably, you know, who obviously finished the score.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was an interesting credit. I didn't know that he had worked on that film before he passed away. But overall, I found it very entertaining. I am with you on the fact that it's rated PG-13. I don't even know. I mean, it's not just like deaths. There's some explicit stuff in this movie. There's a lot of blood in this movie. You know, people get killed violently. There's a lot of arrows through hands and, you know, eyes getting shot out and stuff. And it's like, I was really stunned it got a PG-13. I really was. There's not enough Sarsgaard, who is by far the best thing in the movie.
This is true, too.
He's tremendous in it. He's such a good villain. The opening scene where he goes into the church.
It's great.
Loved it. Great
set. I like that scene.
Beautiful setup for the entire movie. And then he's gone for like an hour and 20 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, and then he's got another couple of great scenes. There's obviously going to be a big showdown at the end, and I like that scene too. Overall, I liked it. I thought it was very entertaining. It's a crowd pleaser for sure. I saw it with a packed, much older audience. It was a really, really older skewed audience that I saw it with on Saturday. But everybody seemed to really enjoy it, and everybody was really pumped afterwards and seemed to have a good time. I think this is an audience pleaser, and I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it, and I am recommending it. I think there's some really great stuff in it. It doesn't, you know, it's 2 hours and like 15 minutes. For me, it didn't feel that way because
it doesn't drag at all.
Not at all. And there's a lot of action in it, a lot of action. And I don't know. I liked it, and I thought the seven characters, you know, they had some fun. And yeah, I thought it was good. It's not, I don't like it as much as the Yul Brynner Steve McQueen version, obviously,
right,
which is a classic. And I don't like it, and then clearly I don't like either of them better than Seven Samurai. But this is perfectly entertaining, and I think a pretty well done Western. And I just have an affinity for Westerns, and I thought this was solid and had a good time. And both my parents loved it. So,
well, there you go.
Yeah, which, of course, you said your father will love it. And
exactly.
I think you're right. My parents, who are in their 70s, thought it was terrific. So,
yeah, everyone's dad will love this movie.
Absolutely right. You're absolutely right. All right. Okay, so what do we got next week?
Next week, we got Deepwater Horizon.
Okay.
We got Tim Burton's new film, Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children.
Yeah.
And we have Masterminds.
Masterminds, which is what, 2 years old?
Not quite.
Okay.
Not quite.
Okay. Colin, are you looking forward to, have you seen any of these? You haven't seen any of them, have you?
I haven't. No, I missed a lot of screenings last week.
Because you're going to catch up a little
Ill.
Bit. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'm looking forward to that, and because, you know, I'm the only one of the three of us who has not given up on Tim Burton.
Colin, have we officially given up on Tim Burton? Oh, did we have that conversation?
Big Eyes was such a disappointment, and yeah. That was the movie where I thought, oh, this is where he's going to return to form, and it just didn't happen. So,
well, all right, that's the one I'm looking forward. That's the one I'm looking forward to the most next week. I really am, because I happen to still really like Tim Burton. So, all right, Colin, get some rest, and I'm not going to hang up on you again next week.
Okay, thanks.
All right, there you go. There's Colin. He's gonna go rest. We're gonna come. We're gonna take a break and come back and talk about the box office with Eric. And Eric, you might not be with us next week because there's some family stuff going on that you may have to take a rain check.
Possibly, yeah. I will definitely let you know during the week.
All right, keep us posted. All right. Mm-hmm. So Eric, hang on. We'll come back after this, and we will we'll talk box office with Eric Childress on 720 WGN. Hey, we're back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here, 720 WGN. Yeah, we're back. And we've got the box office to talk about here. And then we're going to talk about, Vulture.com is a website. And they took all 169 episodes of Seinfeld, every single episode of Seinfeld, and they ranked them from best to worst or worst to best. And we're going to talk about that and talk about the best and worst Seinfeld episodes of all time. I found the list to be interesting, and I disagree with a lot of it, so we're going to get into that. And then my dad's going to call in and tell a joke as well, because it's Monday, and it's a jokey time. Monday morning movie reviews. We just finished reviewing the new movies, and now we'll talk about box office. Eric, tell everybody how they can see you on the TV talking box office.
Yes, every Thursday morning at 5 a.m., set your DVRs to WYCC on whatever channel your Comcast provider might have. The show is called Business First AM, and there's a segment called Movies and Money that I'm on there with Angela Miles, and we do a segment highlighting the new releases of the week and how the box office is looking. Okay. Basically, just a little preview of what we do here.
And what the box office piece that you write is at movies.com.
Correct.
And you put that up usually on Sunday afternoons.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so we've got that. I've got that in front of me. So let's talk about the box office. And again, you can check out movies.com to read this whole thing. All right, number one movie of the week, and we were both kind of last week. We were like, is it going to be Storks? Is it going to be Magnificent Seven? And you and I were both kind of talking back and forth about it. And it turned out to be solidly the Magnificent Seven with $35 million.
Yeah, pretty easy win. I got my theory on why Storks might not have done as well, but this is pretty much exactly what I was expecting Magnificent Seven to do. I mean, just the hype around it, the cast, these adults are sort of flocking the box office now as we see that Sully is doing still really well. This is one of the biggest September openings ever. Just supplanting even The Equalizer, which from a couple years ago was one of the biggest September openings ever.
And is it? I mean, does this still say that Denzel Washington is a great pull, a great box office pull, or is it just the recognition of the title and the fact that there are a bunch of other people in the film as well?
Well, I mean, I think that the Denzel is clearly a pull. I think the same thing with, but we see with Tom Hanks, that, you fill in you know, half of the draw with the movie star, and then you have to fill in the other half with something they want to see.
Yeah.
And, you know, Tom Hanks and Sully seems to be a perfect combination. You know, that, you know, anytime you turn him into a captain and you're making dollars.
Right.
with Denzel, I mean, clearly, I mean, you got Magnificent Seven, you have name recognition, you have what is, you know, this isn't quite the cast that they were originally trying to pull together. If you remember when this project was conceived some years ago, there was talk that it was going to be like Tom Cruise and Matt Damon and stuff. Mm. And it ended up being, you know, Denzel Washington, Ethan Hawke, and Chris Pratt. You know, it's, you know, certainly not a roadshow version of it.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, and I think, you know, like Chris Pratt, you know, clearly, I'm sure brought in some of the younger people.
Yeah.
You know, maybe not the screening you attended. But,
no, not the screening. No, the screening. Here's the deal. My dad's 75 years old.
Yeah.
We walk in, we sit down. My dad leans over and he goes, "Everybody in here is 90. He goes,
"Well, that's what I said. Adults are flocking to the box office right now, and that's clear. And Magnificent Seven is in a position where the amount of money it's made, and the fact that it got an A-minus cinema score. There have only been two movies since 1999 that did not make it to $100 million.
Yeah.
As a result of that combination.
I'll tell you this though, that I think it's a real crowd pleaser, and I've only seen the movie just the one time. And the audience I saw it with ate it up. They had a great time. So I think this thing is going to do really well. And the only competition it really has next week is the Marky Mark movie, right?
Yeah, and I'm curious to see how that plays. I mean, here's another case of what we just said. You have Mark Wahlberg, who has clearly been a draw for a number of movies. And you know, would people rather see the Western or the movie of true story where they're running from fire?
Yeah. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, how many movies has he made with Peter Berg now?
Just two, I think.
Oh, just two? Just Lone Survivor?
Maybe produce some stuff. I mean,
oh, okay.
they work on Ballers.
Oh,
together.
Right. Okay.
They're both producers of Ballers.
Right, okay.
And so they did Lone Survivor. And Peter Berg was not the original director of this movie either. I'm blanking on who was originally supposed to do this.
Oh, is that right?
I think it was J.C. Chandor.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think he was originally attached to this at one point. I have to double check that. But he ended up dropping out, and so Wahlberg was already attached. So I'm assuming he just called
Peter Berg.
"Hey, you want a job?"
Yeah. All right. Number two this week is Storks with 21.8 million, which that's an underperformance, isn't it?
I think it is. Yeah, and the tracking, which has been way off so often this year, the whole tracking industry, I think, has taken a really big hit this year on its predictive qualities. And they had this thing in the high 20s, maybe even low 30s, even. And it seemed like I was thinking like mid 20s, you know, or high 20s for this. But I'm wondering if parents just did not want to have the conversation.
You know, that's a good point. And Colin did talk about that, about how you wouldn't have to have it. And I think the movie is so innocuous that having seen it, it's so innocuous that I don't think it would come up.
Right.
But that's true. That's legitimate.
But why take the risk?
But no, you're absolutely right. That's a legitimate point as to why maybe this movie underperformed a little bit, because I don't, you know, my kid's six and I don't want to have to have the talk.
Yeah. And maybe now that people have seen it and, you know, parents will talk to other parents and say, like, "Nah, you can take your kid.
Yeah.
You're not going to have that conversation yet."
Yeah.
And it's got, other than the Tim Burton movie next week, it really has no competition for the family dollar until Trolls opens in
November.
And
that's in November. So that's a whole, you got well over a month.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. Number three, Sully, $13.8 million, bringing its total up to $92 million. Solid hit, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's going to be one of probably Clint Eastwood's third biggest grossing film ever. Tom Hanks's 15th $100 million grosser, not counting the Toy Story movies.
Jeez.
Yeah, 19th overall, the three Toy Story movies and Polar Express, if you want to count those.
Wow, unbelievable. So. All right, that's cool. And then number four is Bridget Jones' Baby. In 2 weeks, $16 million. That's not good in this country, correct?
Correct. $16 million here, but over $67 million overseas.
Wow.
So the money that this thing is making internationally is going to put Universal in the profit margin on this.
Okay. Number five. Wow, this thing tanked. Snowden, $4.1 million, 2 week total, $15 million bucks for the Oliver Stone movie.
Yeah, I mean, $40 million doesn't sound like a lot of money for, you know, for any movie these days, pretty much. But an Oliver Stone movie with, you know, the star of the guy, you know, star of the movie that, you know, Robert Zemeckis couldn't open last year.
Yeah.
And it's just, I feel really bad for Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Yeah, I do
because
too.
Because he's the one that's going to be taking the hit on this movie. You know, yeah. Oliver Stone will find money to do something else again, but
yeah. And Joseph Gordon-Levitt is an enormously talented actor.
Yes, he is.
And an insanely likable guy.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it sucks that, you know, I mean, I didn't think the movie was very good, but it sucks that that he is going to take the hit, and he is.
Yeah.
And people, if you've not seen the Walk, do it.
Flock to it.
It's a great movie.
Yeah.
Number six, man, Blair Witch, $3.9 million. Now, it's made $16 million so far, but, you know, and again, it didn't cost anything, but weren't the expectations much higher for this?
Oh, yeah. This thing is not going to gross total what people thought it was going to do in its opening weekend.
Mm.
And, I mean, this thing is probably going to finish somewhere maybe just above 20, maybe. And it's only like $21 million worldwide. It's only a $5 million budget. So it's, you know, it's not a disaster by any stretch of the imagination. And it'll probably even make a few bucks. But Lionsgate was hoping for some big money on this one.
Yeah.
And, again, I think the title scared him off.
I think so, too.
And called it The Woods.
Yeah.
As generic as that might have sounded, I think they would have doubled their money.
Yeah, on the opening weekend, but then once word of mouth came out.
Yeah. Oh, hey, guys, it's Blair Witch. Don't go see it.
No, it sucks. I mean, the movie sucks.
That too.
So, yeah. I mean, and I think word of mouth, like, people are like, hey, I'm thinking about going to see the Blair Witch. No!
Right.
And then on the opposite end of the spectrum, Don't Breathe.
Yeah.
$3.8 million, $81 million total. Did you expect this movie to...
No. No, I didn't. I mean, even as good as it is, and, you know, I saw it at, when I saw the South By, I didn't know what kind of release it was going to get.
Yeah.
For one. And, I mean, it's Screen Gems, and they have been known to open horror movies. I mean, Prom Night opened really huge for Screen Gems, for God's sake.
Yeah.
The Prom Night remake. But this is now the third highest grossing film in the history of the Screen Gems division.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's a pretty remarkable story this year, and hey, you know, we're always happy when good movies make money.
Yeah,
and this is just, you know, Fede Alvarez will get to make another movie because of it.
That's fantastic, and the opposite of Blair Witch, great word of mouth.
Right.
I don't know anyone who didn't like this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Number eight, Suicide Squad, still hanging in there.
Yeah. Speaking of movies that I don't know anyone who likes this thing.
I know. I don't know anybody who liked it either.
Yeah, I don't know why. I mean, why this thing is still lingering? Why? I mean, are people buying tickets to this just to boost it and going into other movies? I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know why this movie is hanging on and doing as well as it has.
Maybe it's just people are like, I don't know. They're just, I'm curious. I'll just go.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe. I mean, I don't.
I mean, I could have waited. I could have waited till the thing came out, you know, on DVD, because I missed it on the opening weekend.
Right, right.
But I was on vacation when it opened.
I was shocked when I heard you and saw it. I'm just like, why?
I know, I did. I was shocked myself. especially afterwards.
Oh, yeah.
So, number nine, When the Bow Breaks. I liked the way you referred to this subgenre.
Yeah.
As the Lifetime movies aimed at African Americans.
Yeah.
That's pretty much what they are.
Yeah, this is the Screen Gems division,
yeah.
And you think, I mean, in 2009 they had a movie called Obsessed with Stringer Bell.
I know, I saw that.
You remember that
yeah,
one?
Yeah, I know.
Okay, and then a couple of years ago in 2014 they had another Stringer Bell domestic disturbance movie called No Good Deed.
Right.
Okay, which made quite a bit of money.
Yeah.
Small, little budget, made a lot of money, could have been on Lifetime.
Yeah.
Then last year they had the movie called The Perfect Guy.
That's right.
Same scenario as any Lifetime movie you see every Saturday night,
yep,
or any night for that matter.
True.
And it's just, and when the Bow Breaks, I mean, I don't have to see the movie. I've seen it before.
Right. And then number 10 is Kubo and the Two Strings, which is up to almost $46
million,
which is just a disappointment in general.
Just sad.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, I mean, Storks is going to outgross it eventually, yeah. And it's just, I don't know. I mean, it's again, it's a tough sell, for people. It's just for a variety of reasons.
Yeah.
But it's a beautiful movie.
It's a beautiful movie.
Oh, it's a beautiful movie, and I think people that were listening to people like us praise it is one of the reasons the thing is. Yeah. Stuck around as long as it has, but like you know, this does is going to do under 50 million. Pizza Dragon is just kind of hovering around 75 million.
It's too bad,
you know. But Secret Life of Pets,
yeah,
like 750 million worldwide.
Wow. All right, next week, Deepwater Horizon, Masterminds, and Mrs. Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children.
Yeah,
and that's what we got next week. All right, all right, Eric, thanks, man.
Yeah,
and I will. Hopefully, I'll talk to you next week. Otherwise, we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Sounds good.
All right, buddy. Take care.
Later.
Eric Childress on WGN. He might be taking a week off now. He might be taking a week off, so we're going to see if Jim Leskowski can fill in for him while we review all the new movies next Monday, which will happen again.